Our speaker today is Dr. Melissa Homestead, the Susan J. Rosowski Associate Professor of English here at UNL. Dr. Homestead received her PhD in English from University of Pennsylvania in 1988. She's a prolific author. In 2005, she published a book with Cambridge University Press called American Women Authors and Literary Property, 1822 to 1869, based, I believe, on your PhD dissertation. She must be going through some kind of a spurt of creativity because she has just a number of works forthcoming, just published, just out, or in the pipeline. It's quite impressive. She has published numerous journal articles, book chapters, biographical entries, and introductions, as well as having served as editor of several critical editions and annotations. For example, here's one, a 3,000-word entry, given the economical title of Willa Cather, is forthcoming in the Blackwell Encyclopedia of Women in World History. Since she has published a number of articles and books on Willa Cather, and perhaps coincidentally holds the Susan Rosowski Chair, it's not too much of a surprise to learn that she's also the interim director of the Cather Project. Finally, I want to note that she's a good friend of the Center for Great Plains Studies, currently serving on our Board of Governors and having served for 3 years on the Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize Committee, including last year as its chair. And by the way, isn't it sweet to have a Professor Homestead lecturing at the Center for Great Plains Studies? Doesn't that sound like Colonel Mustard in the library with a knife? Some things are just meant to be, I think. Professor Homestead's talk today is entitled, as you see up here, Plains Regional Fiction and the National Literary Market, the case of Bess Streeter Aldrich as A Lantern in Her Hand.
So first, how many of you have read A Lantern in Her Hand? Oh, yay. This is very good. Well, one of the things that got me interested in reading A Lantern in Her Hand is that most academic literary historians do not read Bess Streeter Aldrich. And I came to read Aldrich when I was teaching my first year here, a course at the 300 level, an undergraduate course called Willa Cather and Her World. And the course was left open as to what her world might be in literary terms or cultural terms. And so I wanted to think about Cather in the tradition of women's regionalist fiction. I had a great interest in Sarah Orne Jewett and the late 19th century New England regional writers. But now Cather, of course, even though she is a Nebraska author in some ways, in other ways is not, including the fact that a lot of her fiction, most of her fiction, is set outside of Nebraska and the Plains region. So I wanted to line her works up with representations of the regions in her fiction with other women's regional writing. And I can't remember exactly how I first found A Lantern in Her Hand and realized she was a Nebraska author, but without having read the book, I decided to put it on my syllabus because I read, like on Amazon.com, anybody can put up reviews. And there were all of these passionate testimonials about the novel on Amazon.com. So I thought, well, this is interesting. And it was also interesting for me because my scholarship, I mean, I've been a Cather fan since I was in high school, but my scholarship before I started going back to Cather about 6 or 7 years ago was on the 19th century, and I work on popular women's fiction. So moving into the 20th century, I thought, well, the last time I studied the 20th century, nobody was talking about the more popular women writers. Who's out there? And Aldrich, I think, fits into that category. And also, as far as the question of, in the 20th century, literary historians tend to say, oh, something sentimental, and then they just don't read it. In the 19th century, we say something is sentimental, and then we analyze it. So I wanted to do that moving into the 20th century. Now, my talk today is very tentative, in part because a couple of years ago, I wrote an article about Cather and Aldrich and fan letters to them, and thinking about them both as sort of popular middle-brow authors. That was actually kind of intentionally perverse to do that to Cather, but I wanted to put Cather and Aldrich together, and that's how I did it. And I did research at the Nebraska State Historical Society, which has Aldrich's papers, which are an amazing resource. There are very few authors that you have a set of papers like that. She kept carbons of outgoing correspondence. She kept most of her incoming correspondence. There are drafts of her books. There's just an amazing archive for an author. But right now, the Nebraska State Historical Society is doing very necessary work on its building, which doesn't have modern, or didn't last year, have modern climate control and fire suppression systems. And the cheapest and safest way to do that work was to close the library and shrink wrap their stacks, basically, while they do that work. So her papers have not been available for more than a year at this point, so I could not go back to them. But still, from what I could do, I'm also going to be using, in her paper, she has clippings of advertisements and reviews, and I couldn't get to those. So I was using digital versions of some modern 20th century newspapers, and they are scans of microfilms. So the quality is pretty poor. But I'm going to use them anyway, because even if you can't read the words, I'll tell you the words, and there are interesting things about the way that these advertisements appear in newspapers. Okay, so here we go with the talk proper. When Bess Streeter Aldrich sent the typescript of her novel, A Lantern in Her Hand, to her publisher in 1928, she'd been a moderately successful author of fiction set in the small towns and farms of rural Nebraska for more than 15 years. Born and raised in northern Iowa, she moved to Elmwood, Nebraska in 1909 when her husband bought a bank there. So she was writing what she knew. From the start of her career as a published author, her work circulated in national venues. Her first short story published as an adult appeared in the Ladies' Home Journal in 1911 when it won a short story contest. However, her works appeared only in magazines until 1924 when Mother Mason, a collection of short stories featuring the same characters, appeared. The firm that published her first book and ultimately published all of her books was D. Appleton & Company, an old-line New York publisher with early 19th century roots. Appleton also published and published her first novel proper, The Rim of the Prairie, in 1925, and another episodic collection of stories, The Cutters, in 1926. Whether or not that's a novel or a stories, in any event, A Lantern in Her Hand was her most ambitious work to date, a decade-spanning historical novel concentrating the history of the state of Nebraska and the life of a single female character, Abby Deal. The novel tracks her from a childhood and young adulthood in Iowa before Nebraska was opened for settlement until her death in 1927 in a house built on the property she and her husband, Will, homesteaded. So the novel, actually, she wrote herself up to the time that she finished writing the novel. Now, one might assume that her long record of publication in national magazines and her secure relationship with an old, established New York book publisher and with her editor there, Rutger Bleeker Jewett, would make Aldrich feel confident about presenting her rural, regional subject matter to a wide audience. She seems to have had misgivings, however, about what readers and critics would make of the life of her farm wife on the flatlands. As it turns out, the publication of Lantern was a transformative moment in Aldrich's career, and this paper will consider how an Elmwood author and her New York publisher made Lantern a bestseller and established Aldrich as a recognizable brand, a Plains regionalist in a national book market. Aldrich's nervousness about the reception of her novel comes through in the original typescript, particularly in the introductory chapter, which takes place on the day of Abby's death. Her New York editor, who had never set foot in Nebraska, okay, this is very sensitive, so if I start zipping ahead, let me know. So her New York editor, who had never set foot in Nebraska, wrote to her suggesting changes to the final scene, sentences of the chapter. He said, "I challenge your statements on page 7 of the manuscript. Of course, this story will appeal especially to all who know the pioneer life from experience or family tradition, but this will not be the only group who will love the story of Abby Deal. You are too modest. For instance, I am in the class of ordinary readers and looking forward with the keenest interest to reading your story of a pioneer woman. Instead of stating then that only those who have this special knowledge will find appeal in the story, why not state that with this group especially, the story will be understood best? In the sentence on page 7, how about softening the expression of the verb will to may? You are selling your story short, prejudicing the reader before he gets into the swing of the novel. Do not be so modest. This will be a fine book, the result of hard work on your part. Hold your head high, explain nothing, and apologize for less." Aldrich never balked at revising her stories repeatedly until she could get a magazine that would accept them. She had a very practical attitude about this. So she gladly accepted Jewett's suggestion for revision. She slightly modified her language in the sentences he pointed to, making her statements less dogmatic. And what we have here, we've got two things. The original typescript without the markup. So this is the text, and you can see in the typescript, which I couldn't get an image of, places where she's crossed out and made emendations. And then these are the galley proofs, where you can see the amended sentences and then further revision to the amended sentences. Several months later, with novel and galley proofs, she went even further. She removed the six final sentences and all the qualifications they contained, which sold her story short. Instead, she ended her introduction with a simple declarative statement about the chapters that followed. This is the story of the old lady who died while the meat burned and the children played Run Sheep Run across her yard. So that's quite a change. She's not saying nobody is going to want to read this book unless they know this subject matter. She's saying this is what this book is about. And it's also, I think, actually there is a kind of logic of her reservations. Anyone who knows the story of how she wrote the novel, she solicited family and community anecdotes and elaborately arranged them chronologically and put them into Abby's life. So there was a sense in which I think she felt like she was sending these materials back to the people who had given them, and they were all affiliated with Nebraska. Aldrich had reason to be nervous about the judgment of elite East Coast critics regarding her novel. As Willa Cather ruefully noted in 1931, reflecting back on the publication of her second novel, O Pioneers, in 1913, she didn't expect anyone to be interested in, quote, a story concerned entirely with heavy farming people, with cornfields, pasture lands, and pig yards. Set in Nebraska, of all places. As everyone knows, she continues, Nebraska is distinctly déclassé as literary background. Its very name throws the delicately attuned critic into a clammy shiver of embarrassment. A New York critic voiced a very general opinion when he said, I simply don't care a damn what happens in Nebraska, no matter who writes about it. Highbrow critics didn't, however, determine the success or failure of a novel with a class of ordinary readers that Rucker Jewett put himself in. As Janet Galligani Casey has recently observed in A New Heartland, Women, Modernity, and the Agrarian Ideal in America, even though most novels featuring rural agrarian subject matter have not, quote, survived the sifting and sorting process that results in a recognizable modern American canon, they were at the center of the literary mainstream to the extent that they were disproportionately represented on bestseller lists. And Cather is the great exception here in some ways. As Casey argues, many people felt a desire to fend off, quote, the proliferating specialized discourses clamoring for their attention. And rural novels then found a large readership among those who sought to imaginatively align themselves with, quote, a romantic past rather than an unstable present, a life of production rather than consumption, and with a homespun, plain-spoken wisdom. Although Casey doesn't include Lantern in her study, except a passing reference to a negative review of it, her analysis provides a fair account of one way that many of Aldrich's readers likely engaged her novel. Aldrich's publisher, D. Appleton & Company, and her editor, Rutger Jewett, are known to literary historians primarily for making Edith Wharton's books commercially successful. However, as the firm and the editor also knew from experience, there was room on their list for fictions of the regional and the rural, not just New York society novels. In the 1920s, in the years preceding the appearance of Lantern, Appleton published the Southern Historical Romances of Thomas Nelson Page, notorious racist, by the way, the Western Historical Novels of Emerson Hough, John Milton Oskeeson's Oklahoma novels, works by the popular, prolific Western novelist Frank C. Robertson, Zona Gale's stories of Midwestern life in small towns and in Chicago, and the late career works of Harold Bell Wright, whose hugely popular novels in several genres are set in various Western locales. Wright's a particularly interesting figure in this context because of the place he occupies in the history of book advertising. Before the 1920s, most old-line book publishers did very little advertising for their books. As Ellen Gruber Garvey describes the traditional methods of book advertising, until 1920 or so, old-line publishers advertised trade books, fiction and general nonfiction sold in retail stores, with restrained announcements, perhaps quoting from a review or an endorsement. Old-line publishers saw book advertising beyond such informational announcements as useless. They simply had to let the natural readers of a particular book know about it so they could buy it. They also saw advertising as detrimental to their profits because every penny spent on advertising came out of their profits. Harold Bell Wright's publisher before Appleton, however, was anything but old-line. As Aaron Smith explains, Wright's work was published not by a regular trade publisher, but by book jobber Ellsbury Reynolds of the Book Supply Company, who sold his books through the mail, thus reaching a large non-urban audience that cannot easily access bookstores. And actually, the majority of the U.S. population, even the early 20th century, could not access bookstores. As Smith also observes, Reynolds, a book distributor who engaged in no original publishing except of Wright's books, was located in Chicago, making him both in his business methods and geographically far away from New York, the center of the book trade. Elsbury Reynolds also invested significant sums of money in advertising Wright, making him into a brand for readers seeking wholesome fiction of life outside the corrupt cities. And they really did spend huge amounts of money on advertising, and it really paid off. More mainstream publishers in the early 20th century began to take note of the power of advertising, although the process was slow. In a speech to the National Bookmen's Association in 1920, advertising writer Helen Woodward castigated publishers for their unwillingness to rethink advertising. She set out a program of reform for book advertising, including a recommendation, quote, that publishers invest in an author with the same foresight which a new soap manufacturer might invest in soap. And she cited Harold Bell Wright as an example of the benefits of systematic advertising as a means to build up an author's reputation rather than focus on selling individual books. So this is a crucial distinction. Do you have the author be a name, or do you just list books? When Appleton began publishing Wright, they advertised him lavishly, often focusing as much or more attention on Wright as an author as on the new novels appearing under his name. In advertising The Mind with the Iron Door, Harold Bell Wright takes pride of place in the ad, with a long paragraph touting him as the most popular of living writers, each of whose 9 previous novels averaged sales of 1,268,000 copies each. So it's not just more than a million. This makes it sound like a real statistic. No writer could have attracted and held through a decade so vast an audience unless he possessed to a far greater degree than his contemporaries the power to give American readers the kind of books which entertain them the most, thrill them the most, inspire them the most, and make them eager for each subsequent volume to appear. In 1925, the word Wright dominated Appleton's ad for a son of his father, with the name of the book's publisher virtually invisible. In 1927, Appleton took pains to draw attention to the connection of Wright's new novel, God and the Groceryman, to much earlier novels published by the Book Supply Company, The Shepherd of the Hills and The Calling of Dan Matthews. They touted God and the Groceryman as a story to reach the hearts of millions by the most popular author in the world, which is really not hyperbole. These ads thus take pains to construct Wright as what Michel Foucault calls an author function, a linguistic sign under which readers can classify texts, grouping them together, defining them, differentiating them from, and contrasting them to others. So there are Harold Bell Wright novels. And this construction of Wright as an author function takes place at the expense of Appleton's identity as a source of Wright's fiction. Now, back to Aldrich. Probably thinking, why all this Harold Bell Wright? Now, despite Rutger Jewett's enthusiasm for Lantern and his assurance that readers not prairie-born and bred would read it, Appleton's advertising campaign for the novel in 1928 was strictly low-key and old-school. An early advertisement simply announced, "A Lantern in Her Hand by Bess Streeter Aldrich, a novel of the Midwest pioneers, the moving story of 3 generations. Appleton, $2. Another early ad was so vague as to be meaningless. And now this one actually is here. And these are all Appleton books listed there. It's so vague as to be meaningless. The wonderful story of a lovely character. This book we can recommend to everyone. This ad, like most I've found, embeds Lantern in a group of ads for other Appleton novels, thus emphasizing the publisher we recommend over the book or the author. I found only one early advertisement that at least foregrounds the subject of the book, a new novel of the Midwest pioneers, and through an illustration suggests a main female character. Notably, this ad also suggests that even readers of a metropolitan East Coast paper, like the New York Times, recognize novels about pioneers in the Midwest as a genre or market niche. So you say it's a novel of the pioneers, and it's like, I've read other novels like that, so maybe I'll buy this one. As Aldrich anticipated, Lantern was lambasted by some Eastern critics. The Saturday Review of Literature headlined its review simply, "Hokum." And the reviewer complained that it was, quote, "compounded to formula from beginning to end." Indeed, his criticism follows the logic of this advertisement by recognizing the Midwestern novel as an established genre and Lantern as comprising, quote, "everything that is traditional in the Midwestern novel." Almost despite himself, he also confesses to having enjoyed reading it, perhaps because, quote, "the reviewer was tired and his guard was down, or else Mrs. Aldrich has command of simple pathos." Many reviews, however, were positive, And while Appleton's ads for the novel remained small and bare bones, ads began using quotations from reviews to testify to the high quality of the novel and to briefly characterize its subject matter. And this is still really sort of the old style of advertising a book. So here we have a novel of the Midwest pioneers, as thrilling and joyously fresh as the prairie sky, quoted from the St. Louis Times. The story, that's the upper right there, of a pioneer mother and her sturdy family is being acclaimed everywhere, and then quoting again from the St. Louis Times. And in this ad, oops, which actually you really can't read this at all, but it's a long list of Christmas books. A strong, vigorous picture of pioneer life, intense humanness, the Boston Transcript says. Appleton even deployed Eastern critical authority in its appeal to Midwestern readers, asking readers of the Chicago Daily Tribune, and the ad is actually in the bottom right-hand corner, "Have you read this fine novel?" And quoting a positive review in the New York Times, which said, "With real sympathy, beauty of expression, and intuitive accuracy, Mrs. Aldrich has infused her book with the rugged spirit of the earlier West. She traces with both clarity and skill the figure of a genuine pioneer." And here's the Boston Transcript quoted to the New York Times. "Its intense humanness is accented by the living reality of the characters who walk across its pages." Although novels generally attracted some of their largest sale earlier in their runs, that's what the old model of book advertising implied, just let people know it's available and they'll go buy it. Appleton realized about 6 months into Lantern's run that something unusual was occurring. Sales were increasing rather than decreasing. Their advertising appeals began to change as they deployed a strategy that goes back to at least the 1850s, advertising a novel's high sales and popularity to promote further high sales. So everybody else has already bought it, so you should buy it too, is pretty much the message. So at the top of this ad, we have 10 large printings have already been needed to meet the steadily increasing demand for A Lantern in Her Hand. And this is March 1929. It's September 1929. A year after its first publication, Lantern was by no means a new book, which is what this ad is headlined, but Appleton included it in a list of new books we recommend. The advertisement provides no more in its listing for Lantern than the novel's title, author, and the statement, "This fine novel has gone through its 15th large printing, so please make it go through its 16th, right? With a tautological vagueness that recalled some of the early ads, and this is... See, under international bestseller, that's the one we're going to be looking at here. Wait a second. With a tautological vagueness that recalled some of the early ads, another September 1929 ad proclaimed, "Lantern, a truly American novel that all America is reading." This ad further foregrounds Lantern's sales and popularity, reaching beyond the region and the nation to the international, by featuring it in an ad under the prominent title, "International Bestsellers." "America's taste is international these days," the introductory paragraph explains, "and here are three best-selling novels, English, French, and American." Lantern is the American. All three of which thousands of novel readers are enjoying. Which is most to your taste? By early 1930, ads conjoined this claim about all America is reading it with an announcement of its 23rd printing. And then Appleton, here you can see, upper left-hand corner, gave the novel pride of place in a special advertisement that touted a group of books that were still selling after the flurry of the fall book season. The shouting and the tumult die, and certain books continued to spread in an ever-increasing popularity, Appleton announced. "These are the books that no one should miss, that have definitely arrived as permanent contributions. Here are fiction and biography that you should add to your shelves of books to own and keep." Of Lantern in particular, the ad advised, "First published in August 1928, the splendid novel is the bestseller among bestsellers, and its story of pioneer characters is finding thousands of readers in every section of America today. Sales now are 1,500 to 4,000 copies a week." Despite this advertisement's suggestion that readers would want to own their own copies, in late 1929, Lantern also began to occupy a striking position in lending libraries. Although Lantern never cracked the top 10 in bestseller lists, residing instead in the top 25, it occupied a remarkably stable position in the Bookman's Monthly Score, published in Bookman's Magazine. This list, compiled by a librarian from Massachusetts, was designed to track the books most in demand by public library borrowers. While many other novels came and went, reflecting reader demand for new titles, Lantern hovered on or around the 10th position for more than a year. Thus, in September 1929, Lantern is ranked at 9. In December, it was ranked 11th, and then we have February, July, and then again September, it's at 12th. And if you sort of look here, for instance, when you have those asterisks, that means new to the list. So you see here, two new to the list, many new to the list, and Lantern is just staying on the list through all of that time. After 4 years of steady and growing sales of Lantern, Appleton's approach to advertising Aldrich's next novel, A White Bird Flying, reflected a significant shift in their understanding of this Nebraska author's place in the national literary market. She didn't receive the same full-page treatment of Harold Bell Wright's first Appleton novel, and indeed, Aldrich's sales never reached the height of Wright's. No one's did. Nevertheless, Appleton began to advertise Aldrich as an author, not just her individual books in isolation or primarily in the context of Appleton's list. Instead, her name, her face, and the title of her bestseller introduce A White Bird Flying. As in the case of Appleton linking Wright's God and the Grocery Man to previous novels, even though they were novels published by another publisher, ads also played up the status of A White Bird Flying as a sort of sequel to A Lantern in Her Hand. And for those of you who don't know, it's the granddaughter of Abby Deale who is the heroine. A Lantern in the Hand, Lantern in Her Hand, the next generation, if you will. Another great story, no one watches Star Trek here, you didn't get it. Anyway, another great story of life in the Middle West, the ad copy advises, which all America will now be discussing. Laura Deale, granddaughter of that heroic pioneer character, Abby Deale, finds herself at the crossroads of life, forced to make the most momentous decision that can confront the young woman of today. Another ad, instead of her face, we get the book as an object, and it announces, practically at the moment of the book's publication, the big novel of 1931, exclamation point. Interestingly, this ad doesn't prominently feature Aldrich's name or face, as in the other advertisements, but it nevertheless constructs her as an author function, the author of The Lantern in Her Hand. That is, whereas advertisements for Lantern did not mention Mother Mason, The Edge of the Prairie, or The Cutters, which might make you think that she'd only written one book at that point. The ads for A White Bird Flying classify the novel as part of a body of work connected to each other by source. A week after predicting that White Bird would be the big book of 1931, ads trumpeted, already a huge success. As indeed it was. The month of its release, it was ranked number 3 by the Chicago Tribune in fiction, and number 2 by the New York Times. The list is in the middle there. Cather's Shadows on the Rock was number 1 on both lists, a novel set in 17th century Quebec, not Nebraska. But neither Aldrich nor Cather's novel was, in the end, the big book of 1931. That would be Pearl Buck's The Good Earth, notably a farm novel. By November, ads trumpeted the status of A White Bird Flying as an instant classic, a novel that will be a bestseller when other bestsellers have been forgotten, supporting the claim with a claim about A Lantern in Her Hand sales status for 3 years a bestseller. Quoting positive reviews from papers in Philadelphia, Brooklyn, Denver, Oakland, and St. Paul, the ad spans the nation by region in a mere column. In a further gesture to the connection between Lantern and White Bird, the ad informs readers at the bottom that they can buy a box set of the two novels featuring the Deale family heroines. Now, I would like to close with some thoughts about the questions I gestured towards in my title. And for those of you who aren't the academics, this is the part where I'll get a bit more academic. Just what can the case of Aldrich's novel tell us about the place of Plains regional fiction in the national literary market in the 1920s and the 1930s? In the course of my talk, I've made Willa Cather a point of reference more than once. As Guy Reynolds points out in his essay, Willa Cather's Case, Region and Reputation, Cather is a peculiar case as a Nebraska regionalist, in part because we can, as he says, say with quantitative certainty that most of her writing was set outside of Nebraska. Furthermore, as Tim Mahoney and Wendy Katz point out in their introduction to the volume in which Reynolds' essay appeared, Regionalism in the Humanities, which grew out of a symposium here, the fact that Cather lived most of her life outside of Nebraska in the Plains region makes her more typical than atypical of literary regionalists. As they explain, quote, the regionalist writer or artist is almost always someone who leaves the region for a time or for good, or an outsider who immerses him or herself in a locality. And there are lots of examples in late 19th century regionalism of authors who are practically sent by publishers on a mission to acquire new regional subject matter. Put another way, regionalist art is often, quote, produced for the Eastern market, for outsiders by outsiders who define others' cultural peculiarities in order to enforce and reinforce national norms, as well as a ruling elite's control over establishing those norms. In his influential Reading of Regions chapter in his book Cultures of Letters, Scenes of Reading and Writing in 19th Century America, Richard Broadhead analyzes late 19th century literary regionalism in similar terms. And he says, in 19th century America, regional writing was not produced for the cultures it was written about. It was projected toward those groups in American society that made a considerable investment in literary reading. In the late 19th century, Broadhead says, those who had an investment in literary reading were city dwellers in eastern metropolitan areas who read the elite magazines in which regional fiction appeared, such as the Atlantic Monthly, Harper's New Monthly, and the Century. This place of cultural production, as he calls it, meaning those elite magazines, links literary regionalism with the elite need for the primitive made available as a leisure outlet. And that need could be satisfied by taking an imagined journey to a picturesque backward locale through reading regionalist fiction, or through leisure class travel to primitive vacation destinations made newly accessible by railroads and steamships. So either you're going to read a Sarah Orne Jewett story about rural Maine, or you're going to go hang out at an Adirondack Lodge. They're kind of the same thing. In the late 19th century, then, literary regionalism, quote, made places for authors, but made them in a certain position. By virtue of its historical situation, when writers came into authorship through this genre, they found their literary roles bound together with the high zone in a steeply hierarchized plan of culture, and with correlative class prerogatives of leisure and consumption, with a certain socially based appetite for underdevelopment, and with a related will to renew dominance of culturally dominant groups. Now, these analyses of literary regionalism as practiced by authors like Cather or late 19th century regionalists like Sarah Orne Jewett can take my inquiry into Aldrich's regionalism only so far, obviously. Notably, the quality journals that made a place for the authors of late 19th century literary regionalism were on the wane in the 1920s. Furthermore, Aldrich published her fiction primarily in advertising-driven mass-market magazines, such as the American Magazine, that's where she published the most, or the Ladies Home Journal. Places of cultural productions that were identified with the new zone of culture known as the middle brow. And now Janet Galligani-Casey says that's where most urban fiction, or most agrarian novels, rural novels by women resided. So in the great middle of the market, not at the top or at the bottom. And as I said previously, Aldrich had already been publishing her regional fiction in these national mass circulation middle brow magazines for more than 15 years when Lantern was first published. And unlike Cather and many other regionalists, Aldrich wrote about the region from the region, continuing to live in Elmwood during the rest of her writing life. Nevertheless, in order for Lantern to become a long-term bestseller, ultimately selling over 1 million copies and staying in print continuously since 1928, Aldrich had to make a key transition in her sense of herself as an author. As Guy Reynolds observes, the fundamental lesson of Cather's reputation as a regional writer is that in the 20th century, region only counts so far as it figures in the larger national story. Similarly, Aldrich had to imagine that Abby Deal's story could be read with sympathy and pleasure by those who had no connection to the state of Nebraska or other parts of the Plains region. She had to have confidence that the story of the region could figure in a larger national story and reach a national market. By agreeing to cut out her disclaimer about her potential audience in the introduction to her novel, she left room for more readers to embrace her novel and to recommend it to others. And despite what I just said about Aldrich writing about the region from the region, beginning in 1932, she spent long stretches of time in Los Angeles each year, where she publicized her books, sought motion picture contracts for them, and worked on film scripts related to her regional expertise. Miss Bishop, published in 1933, became a major motion picture in 1941. Cheers for Miss Bishop, filmed here in Lincoln, premiere in Lincoln. Parts of it filmed in Lincoln. Much to her regret, A Lantern in Her Hand never became a film. But by going Hollywood and by continuing to write regional fiction through the 1940s, Aldrich claimed a place for herself in Plains regional fiction in the national literary market. Thanks.